Turkey Call All Access, the official podcast of the National Wild Turkey Federation. Brought to you by Nomad. Turkey Call All Access is a digital campfire where we discuss topics of the day, conservation efforts, tips and techniques to better your experience of field, and our members' stories. Welcome back to another episode of the Turkey Call All Access podcast. It is Turkey Week, and we're bringing you a special conversation with the guys from Phelps Game Calls. We're sitting down with James Harrison and Jason Phelps, and we're going to be talking all things turkey calls. We'll hit a little bit on Western hunting versus Midwestern turkey hunting, some different calling tactics, as well as some insights into the history behind Phelps and some of the exciting new turkey calls that they have coming up. So it's a conversation you're not going to want to miss. We're going to get right into that in 90 seconds.
Hey guys, this is Aaron with The Hunting Public. Each spring we head to the woods chasing turkeys, and one overlooked product that we use religiously is Sawyer permethrin. We've used it for years to keep ticks off of us, and it's worked extremely well. We don't like messing around with Lyme disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, anything like that. So I would highly recommend, if you're spring turkey hunting or spending any time in warmer climates in the outdoors, to use Sawyer permethrin. Learn about their advanced insect repellents and family of technical lightweight water filters at Sawyer.com.
Hey y'all, I'm Jason Hart, founder of Nomad Hunting Clothing. At Nomad, we're bringing simplicity and authenticity back to hunting. Whether you hunt to escape your hectic work life, for locally sourced organic meat, or to socialize with friends, to uphold your favorite family traditions, we're with you and we do the same. At Nomad, we understand your gear's an investment, so our products are engineered and priced for every hunter, tested in the real world, and designed to last. Hunting is in all of us. Nomad is with you.
Bass Pro Shops and the National Wild Turkey Federation stand together to help make a difference for the wildlife and scenic lands that enrich our hunting lifestyle. Since 1973, we have positively impacted more than 22 million acres and invested more than $9 million into wild turkey research, an effort supported by Bass Pro Shops. The restoration of the wild turkey is one of America's greatest conservation success stories, but the work is far from over. Through the continued contributions of partners like Johnny Morris and Bass Pro Shops, the NWTF mission is a movement that is delivering the right conservation work at the right place and at the right scale.
Well, welcome back to another episode of the Turkey Call All Access podcast. We are here with Jason Phelps, James Harrison, Philip Matthews, and me, Gilbert, from the communications team. And we're excited. We're talking the Meat Eater Turkey Week. We're going to be talking about some calls. I've been excited for this conversation. I guess before we jump into too much details, if we could go around, just have Jason, James, if you guys could to introduce yourselves for people who don't know who you are, maybe talk a little bit about Phelps and Harrison Custom Calls and, you know, how that got started and what you guys are passionate about. That would be great.
You know, I'll take the lead here, James. So Jason Phelps, I'm the founder and now I'm the GM of Phelps Game Call still, as Meat Eater kind of bought the company there between the 2020 and 2021 seasons. Just out of desire to, you know, as an engineer's mind, I really wanted to make calls with a higher quality, control. And it really started on the elk call side for me. But as I became a very passionate elk hunter, like turkeys kind of took over and became my passion. Cause I don't want to say I ever had elk hunting figured out or elk calling, but I became good at it. And this turkey calling was a new thing. And so I would even argue that at some point, like turkey hunting was more of a fever, more of like a priority for me to try to get this new thing figured out. I'm located here in Southwest Washington. So turkey hunting is very rough. For those that don't know the landscape here, NWTF in partnership with WDFW planted some Easterns here on the west side of the state. a little wetter, and they were doing okay. And so I cut my teeth on hunting eastern birds in Western Washington, which I didn't know at the time. Now that I know a lot more about the subspecies and hunting, was very difficult bird to start with, very stubborn, and you throw in like our densities. So that was my exposure. And then as time went on, money allowed, I started to go to the east side of our state, where I got to hunt Merriam's and Rio's, and that's really where I learned a lot more about turkey hunting there. But then as times went on and I now hunt Kansas and other states, it kind of makes us all come full circle, hunting easterns in Kansas, getting to hunt Rio's and Merriam's here in Washington and Idaho. That's kind of my delivery growing up. And Chris Parrish is responsible for me and James' friendship and connection. Early on, I was working with Chris Parrish, even when he was still at Knight and Hale, on developing some elk calls that were a little different, and ended up flying out to his place somewhere in 2012 or 13. Got to become really good buddies with Chris, who was really my mentor on designing turkey calls as I became more passionate about it. And later on in life, connected me to James Harrison, Steve Morgenstern. And I'm just... as the founder, I realized that I had some stuff to learn. I could build a good turkey call, but there was some stuff that these guys knew that all they knew was turkey calls. And so, with the helps of those three, have really kind of helped build and make that the turkey side, the turkey category within Phelps Game Calls a lot more robust and more impactful.
Out of curiosity, what in your kind of that journey of getting into turkey hunting, when did you start having an interest in making your own calls in that? Was it a response to like, hey, I don't like the way these calls are running, I want something different? Or was it just like, hey, I'm curious about how this works? What was that like for you?
I think it was more of that challenge. I had kind of figured out the elk calls and had those down. And then this, all right, now I've got to stack latex. Now I've got to, it was just different. It was new. And, I think turkey calls, there were good enough ones out there for sure. This was more out of just like my own passion. Like I wanted to go kill a bird with the call that I made. And then, as I was doing a lot of lathe work already out in the shop, building, handmade elk calls was really where we started. Get different sets of jaws and you read some of the forums, because I came from a place of no understanding. So then you just start chucking up wood and building pots and gluing in, soundboards and surfaces and messing with dimensions. And it was really just out of not as much on the elk call side, where I wanted to make stuff better. On the turkey call side, it was just so I could use, these calls on my own to use for hunting.
Yeah. James, what was your journey into call making? Our audience is more familiar with you. Obviously our audience is familiar with Phelps calls as well. But we know you from your owl hoot calls. That's like the claim to fame. What was your journey like into call making?
Well, mine started out, I'm from Hillsboro, Missouri. So Missouri was like the powerhouse state with turkey calling competitions and stuff like that growing up. And I started competing at a young age and running mouth calls and stuff like that. And then, at the time, everybody ran, used their natural voice to owl hooting competitions and stuff. And then Dale Palmer came out with the hoot tube with HS Strut, and he literally got the call so good that nobody could, with their natural voice, could beat him. And so I was like, you know what, if I'm going to compete at this level and continue to be successful in the calling industry and contest calling, I'm going to have to design my own calls that can beat Dale's and stuff like that. So that's kind of what started me on that, was just this. I wanted to, I had the passion to call and I wanted to compete at the highest level and then be the, I wanted to win the contest and be the best out there. And that kind of, I had like 4 years in design development on that owl hooter. I was taking broomstick handles when I first started and cutting them off and making stuff on a sander and really, really, rudimentary ways. And then as I started getting it better, I started figuring out, oh man, this will work. And, it's just a learning process, just like with elk or deer or anything. It's just a process you're learning. And once I got that down and started hitting the contest and started having success with the call, then I was like, I can, word of mouth at that point hit. And then on, it's just been, it's just been nonstop. I mean, it's been wide open owl hooters and going forward. So,
yeah, and you're a machinist by trade, which yep. I feel like is an important thing to know. You're visiting your shop was super cool. Good. All the old lathe equipment and stuff that you have is just awesome. And that's always like for anybody who's making calls, like equipment is a challenge if you know, to get kind of that initial investment. And I love like every year at NWTF convention, which, you know, was just a couple weeks ago, just going through and seeing all of the like amazing call work from, you know, there's so many good call makers out there. But to like make something that really stands out that, you know, that people all across, you know, the turkey hunting world, you know, are like, oh, I want to get this call. I want to get a, you know, a Phelps, or I want to get a one of your owl hooters. Like, I don't know. It's pretty special.
It's awesome. And I felt sorry for Jason when we got talking about the owl hooter, because he's an engineer and he does stuff meticulously. I mean, we work phenomenal together, but I'm a scratch pad kind of guy. All my ideas go on a yellow notebook paper and I pencil it all out, and I was sending him drawings and I kind of felt bad. I told my wife, I was like, man, Jason's gonna think I'm so 1940 still, because that's still how I do everything, you know. It's all pencil and paper and going that route. But the cool thing when I got with Jason was he was, man, I've talked to a lot of guys in the industry, and he is one of the most intelligent guys I've talked to when it comes to this kind of stuff. And when I run an idea across him, he's either A, tried it already, or he's wide open to let's try it and see how it works. And I mean, that's how come Phelps is where it's at today with the quality. It's not the, you know, it's the guys behind it that's making this happen. I mean, it's just, it's top tier. I mean, it's top shelf quality. And I mean, it's not a job to us as much as it is a passion, and we live to and breathe this stuff daily. I mean, I go to bed and worry about things. Oh man, hopefully that O-ring, you know, I mean, I'm sure Jason does the same. Yeah. But
it's been great, you know, since James has come on. And you know, I am an engineer by trade, so I want everything like down to the, you know, 10,000th of an inch. And, you know, but James is funny, because a lot of my best ideas have been like, they come to me they're on a napkin, but then James will send me a napkin. I'll turn it into like a 3D drawing with either me or my CAD guys. We'll run like how we're going to build it. And then James hit the nail on the head. Like, you get to a point where we were both true custom call builders, everything we built, but then you get to a point where it's production and you have to cross this line, right? Where we can't build every single call by hand anymore, just because there's a quantity supply demand, like me and James. And that's where I think a lot of us that we truly do come from a custom call building. Like, James, is this good enough? Like, we hate asking that question. Is this good enough for you? Like, no, this needs to be as good as if we were building these over and over. And that's where me and James have really worked well together. You know, one of these calls we're going to talk about that's upcoming is like the new all 3-in-1 locator. James, you could tell James' passion was getting an owl scream perfected, where me being out west, I wanted the woodpecker to be perfected. And so there were some gives and takes, really. You know, James wanted this thickness of mylar, and I wanted this, and I wanted to change the tone board. And none of us would really give up, which is a good quality, right? Like, none of us are going to settle until we're happy. But we finally got to a point where, hey, the owl scream is exactly how James wants it, and the woodpecker is exactly how I want it. Now we've got a great product. And that's where, you know, number one, being a hunter that just wants to use these things in the woods, but then both of us having machinist engineering backgrounds, like it's been awesome. Really, really love working with James, and I think we got some cool stuff coming out.
In like a quick description, can you tell us what the difference is in a turkey diaphragm versus an elk diaphragm? Like, yeah, is it the reed count or the cut, or what's the difference in those two?
So a little bit of both. So the majority of our turkey calls, you know, usually have a cut top piece of latex. You know, you can nick the second one, and so what happens is typically we stack the lower latex in your mouth shorter, right? And then your top latex that's cuts overhanging. So what it does is those three pieces of latex want to separate, you get pitch breaks. And then by that material that's overhanging that front edge is where we get our rasp from, right? And so if we have a combo cut, you know, you can blow away from the cut, clean the call up, you can blow towards the cut, add the rasp back in. So and turkey calls, I don't want to give away all my secrets, but turkey calls are stretched probably three times tighter, plus or minus, than elk calls. Yeah. For the, at least when we have, like on our amp frame, where we actually put a curved piece of aluminum that goes out and stretches out and sits over top of the latex, where the majority of our turkey calls are what I consider like an old traditional frame, just a flat style frame. And so that's what one major difference, in my opinion. Now, I've designed some great elk calls that are on the old traditional frame, but there's no denying that elk calls play better when they're supported, because we're going up there trying to hold a note that's at, you know, 2000 Hertz, 2200 Hertz for a long extended time, where a turkey call, we go up, bump it, and then we drop off, we bump it and drop it off. But major difference, elk calls are, I love, there are some people that build some doubles, but at least when we've got like our amp frame, not even 90%, we actually change, we had a double, every one of our 100% of our elk calls are single reeds, and that's so you get like a linear stretch, you don't get pitch breaks, you're not trying to fight two reeds, because elk calls don't have rasp, it's supposed to be really clean going up, really clean coming back down, where turkey calls will have, you know, two, three, sometimes even four pieces of latex with the cut. As I mentioned earlier, the elk calls are going to be stretched about a third of the turkey calls, and durability wise, and it may shock a lot of people, like turkey calls, we all know if we take care of them, keep them clean, keep them dried, you can use them season after season. We tell a lot of people on the elk call side, like you get a good 3 or 4 days out of them, like you're probably switching calls up, and that's just the nature of the beast, because they aren't stretched as tight. They do, as soon as that latex laxes or stretches, or you know, you have it in your mouth for 2 hours at a time, you'll lose some of that responsiveness, and you got to kind of go on to the next one.
Okay. That's an interesting, I hadn't thought about the timeline on being able to use those. I know a lot of people like a turkey diaphragm after they've broken in for a while before they get the sound they want, but you don't get much of a break-in period on an elk call, it sounds like.
No, I mean, we always say 5 to 10 bugles kind of sets that reed and kind of gets everything locked in, but it's really ready to go right out of the package. From there, the durability, it's a ticking time bomb, especially if you're going to use it or getting some long call-ins, it wears pretty quick. One thing I do want to note, you know, when a lot of the calls that we grew up with, you know, Nightingale and, you know, Hunter Specialties and, you know, a lot of, you know, the old Primos calls. One thing that I noticed as I started to build out calls is these things are, even though when we order them to build them, they're called adult smalls, they seem like a big old chunk of call in your mouth, right? And so we went a direction that we did on our elk calls. We started to build our turkey calls on what we would consider like an overall medium frame, where we considered that adult small to be like a large frame. And I agreed, me and Parrish talked about it, like we may be able to pull a little bit more out of these larger frames as far as like, but we found that a lot of users preferred that smaller size, it was more comfortable in their mouth, and we've really kind of honed in on like designing our turkey calls around that frame, which was something that we kind of pulled from the elk call side and then kind of added it in to our turkey calls.
Yeah, that makes sense. A lot of the mouth calls that I have, I've cut them down, because the way I got them, I was like, there's no way I'm going to keep this in my mouth for 3 or 4 hours. Super uncomfortable. But what was there an evolution for you? Like when you were getting into turkey calling, did you start with mouth calls, or were there like specific types of calls that you had like phases with that you're like, oh, I'm doing pot calls now? And then
yeah, we kind of jumped all in at once. It was kind of, I've got the mouth call presses. We're building elk calls. Let's do this. But then I also wanted to have the soft jaws and, you know, building the pot calls. And then at the same time, I'm setting up jigs on my drill press to try to figure out how to, you know, build box calls from solid one piece. So it was really kind of an immersion all at once. And then we were just a one-man show. back then. And I remember Chris Parrish actually put me in touch with Steve Morgenstern way back then. And like, hey, Chris is like, hey, this guy builds pot calls, like, to your specs or to his own specs, like, just talk to this Steve Morgenstern guy. And so then we, hey, you know, this is why I'm 100% of my time is focused on elk. You could, you know, start to look at turkey calls. And so we were working with him on different designs and kind of allowed me to release what I would call, like, back then were miniature production runs of turkey calls, why we were, you know, really focused on elk, just because I couldn't do it all. But yeah, it was kind of jumped head first into all turkey because I felt like I had elk to, you know, dialed. So yeah, it was everything. I was trying to, you know, order little, you know, in I don't know if all your listeners know, there's different ways to be a call manufacturer. You can build this thing from the ground up, or there's some websites that sell like kits. So I was buying kits and modifying those and, you know, doing solid block, you know, box calls and turning pot calls, but then buying some, you know, pre-turned pot calls and just kind of mixing and matching materials and trying to figure out what we wanted for a, you know, production. So there's, you know, you have, as a call maker, you got to kind of navigate. And for me, I always took pride in, like, I want to build this thing from the ground up, but I want to check a few of these things that are kind of pre-made to see where that puts us and then, you know, build off of that.
Yeah. I mean, that's very similar to like the dot call world. Philip knows that. Philip makes calls as well. You know, you can order your tone boards and all that stuff pre-made if you want, and then just turn a barrel, which is like, I think probably how a lot of guys who've made dot calls like myself got started trying. It's just like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah,
we'll see how this thing works.
Yep. I mean, that's where our duck call, I mean, not to get into waterfowl, but it's like, oh, Echo sells these guts. All I got to do is turn a barrel and put a band on it, and bam, I got duck call. You know, but that was a great starting point. And then, is your curiosity gets you, you're like, well, I want to design a, you know, a board, or, you know, mess with the back bore and change some things, and, you know, then you're building duck calls from the ground up.
Was there anything like material wise that, when you were doing some experimenting on that was like real wacky, like that you threw in a pot or something that was just like weird?
Yeah. I don't say weird. I didn't get to the point, you know, everybody was doing like, you know, half epoxy, half wood, you know, they were making their own burl. I had never got there. We were just using a lot of black walnut or local stuff, to, you know, U-wood and stuff that was local to me in the Northwest. Wacky and weird is sometimes the burl, like you would get so nervous because you'd order $100 chunk of Amboina burl. Somebody wanted a real fancy one, and then you're just scared to death, like chip it or blow the pot up. But then what would happen is I was more of a technical guy. I would get more frustrated when the call didn't sound right at the end. Like, I just built three of them to this spec, but this burl is so it's just all over the place. And then I'd be really upset. Like, gosh, dang it, it's a $100 call. Like, I really want this thing to sound awesome, but it's dead, or it didn't turn out like I wanted, and you're $100 down. So do you pop, you know, a lot of times I would call the customer like, hey, I'm going to pop out your glass surface for a slate because I need to tone this, you know, or I would try to see if they were okay to let me modify it. So at least it sounded like it was a good turkey call. But yeah, that was my biggest frustration, is I could take, you know, of course, straight grained wood, let's say like hard maple, like, oh, I can make that sound good 10 in a row, but some people really wanted fancier one-off calls. And then I would get anxious going into it. Like, is this thing going to sound right? Is a turkey call when we're done?
Is there like when you're working with weird woods like that or things like that, is it just the variance in like the density of the wood? Like, what are all like the factors that go into making it work or not work?
Yeah. So, I mean, if let's say our wood was consistent over and over, we would set our soundboard height to our playing surface height. We would set the thickness of the bottom. We would set the thickness of the walls, all of that to a certain point. And so, yeah, you get like inconsistent density. It was what I considered the biggest issue, is that you go through a burl, it's basically a bunch of knots. We all know knots are hard. Anytime you've tried to send a screw through one, like, it's, and so you're dealing with a very hard connected to maybe a soft piece or maybe some sapwood on one side of the burl. And so you're just dealing with a bunch of inconsistencies where, you know, if the spot on the pot call you want to call is next to sapwood versus if it's over on the very, you know, the eye side of the burls, like, you just get weird, you know, sometimes get weird, you know, responses out of the call that was perfect on the call before.
Mm. I'm not going to lie. There's part of me that actually loves that. as a non-engineer, there's like a certain amount of like romance to working on the wood.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, I loved watching the call open up and like what it was going to look like. Like it, I'm not an artist by any means, but like, this is as artistic as I'm ever going to get is turning calls and like watching the wood turn into its final shape. And like, this looks awesome. And then more importantly, you'd go to put a striker to it and you're like, oh, duh,
you know? Yes. Yeah. Well, and the striker too makes so much difference on yep. pot calls.
For sure. Yeah, I've got a couple of strikers here that I can wake up a 999, a plastic, you know, aluminum call and just make it sound awesome. So the more I've learned is that if you get a striker teamed up with the right call, it can make a world of difference.
Hey guys, this is Aaron with The Hunting Public. Each spring we head to the woods chasing turkeys, and one overlooked product that we use religiously is Sawyer permethrin. We've used it for years to keep ticks off of us, and it's worked extremely well. We don't like messing around with Lyme disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, anything like that. So I would highly recommend, if you're spring turkey hunting or spending any time in warmer climates in the outdoors, to use Sawyer permethrin. Learn about their advanced insect repellents and family of technical lightweight water filters at Sawyer.com.
Hey y'all, I'm Jason Hart, founder of Nomad Hunting Clothing. At Nomad, we're bringing simplicity and authenticity back to hunting. Whether you hunt to escape your hectic work life, for locally sourced organic meat, or to socialize with friends, to uphold your favorite family traditions, we're with you and we do the same. At Nomad, we understand your gear's an investment, so our products are engineered and priced for every hunter, tested in the real world, and designed to last. Hunting is in all of us. Nomad is with you.
Bass Pro Shops and the National Wild Turkey Federation stand together to help make a difference for the wildlife and scenic lands that enrich our hunting lifestyle. Since 1973, we have positively impacted more than 22 million acres and invested more than $9 million into wild turkey research, an effort supported by Bass Pro Shops. The restoration of the wild turkey is one of America's greatest conservation success stories, but the work is far from over. Through the continued contributions of partners like Johnny Morris and Bass Pro Shops, the NWTF mission is a movement that is delivering the right conservation work at the right place and at the right scale.
It is Turkey Week when this podcast drops. It is Turkey Week. We're time traveling a little bit, but the Meteors putting this together, we're excited to be collaborating with you all on this. Just give us a little bit about, you know, at this point people have seen Monday, Tuesday, kind of what's been happening. What else is coming up in the week? What do people have to look forward to?
Yeah. So Meat Eater just wanted to like really get this, put the spotlight on turkeys. And then we've methodically kind of went through. So you saw on Monday where we were, you know, trying to focus more on hunting tactics, where yesterday, Tuesday, we were looking at like shooting and the foundations for, being a good turkey hunter and having your setup all dialed. And then today we're here with NWTF on purpose to talk about land management and the conservation side. And then coming up, we're going to talk about like dealing with the elements, which is a little bit of the first light side, you know, gear for turkey hunting. And then go back into like early season hunting tactics and stories, and then mid season hunting tactics, and then late season, and kind of just really just put the spotlight on turkey hunting. And then I'm not gonna lie, like a little bit of like what all of the brands within the Meat Eater umbrella have to offer for turkey hunting. I mean, it would, you know, that's one of the points to do this, but really focus, you know, give turkeys the spotlight for the week from all the Meat Eater brands.
Yeah, that's a great segue into I wanted to touch, get you and James's thoughts on maybe a little bit of a preview of like some of those tactics bits on calling, and especially since, you know, we've got kind of a Western perspective. James is from Missouri, Midwestern perspective, and maybe just talk about, yeah, like early season, what are your like go-to calling tactics? And then how does that change as the season progresses for you? And is it like, do you feel like it's real different for, you know, those Western birds versus Midwestern versus Southern?
Yeah, for sure. I'll let James kick this off, and then I'll jump into some of my Western like early season tactics.
Right. Yeah. So, like early season now, I'm running, you know, depending on where I'm hunting at around the house here, I'm running, you know, the full locator calls. The birds are really talking. They're usually gobbling great right now. You know, the hens are just starting to get a little receptive. So the birds are, you know, the gobblers are really vocal. They're hitting the ground. They're gobbling a bunch. This time of year, early season, I'm running my DSD decoys. I'm running, you know, my feeder hen, my posture hen, and then my half strut jakes or full strut, depending on the situation. And the birds are working good on the decoys right now because they're wanting to show dominance. They're wanting to get in there and be the first gobblers to mate with the hens. So the decoys working really good. Calling wise this time of year, it's early season. The birds are, you know, they have zero pressure on them so far from guys hunting them a lot. So I'm getting pretty aggressive. I'm wanting to be that excited hen that them gobblers are answering and coming to. And I'm really ramping it up right now. More so now than once the breeding starts and they're actively, you know, the gobbling starts shutting down, you know, the birds are gobbling great on the limb. Then they hit the ground, they're quiet, you know, and they're with the hens. At that point, I'll ditch the, you know, the half strut decoys and the full strut decoys, and I'll run just hen decoys, and I'll bring my calling down to a little bit more, you know, a little tamer calling. I'm doing more plain yelping, a lot of clucking and purring, scratching the leaves, a little bit of excited cutting, but not as much as I was before, because those gobblers are still wanting to get with the hens and breed, but they don't want to have the competition of fighting other gobblers and going through the pecking order. So I'm just dialing it down with just, so if they do see a decoy, they're seeing hens instead of, you know, no confrontation there. And just more contentment type calls, you know, I'm just easy and calling. Now, once the hens start leaving and start setting on nest more and them gobblers start gobbling again, then I'll ramp up my calling a little bit more and get a little more aggressive with them again and kind of spark them up a little bit. I'm still not running the full strut decoys or the three quarters. I'm strictly on hens at that point because I want that gobbler to come in, know there's no other gobblers around, and just, you know, come on in comfortable. But that's usually my playbook to start with. Now, I can tell you that changes per spring with, you know, like this year around Missouri, we're going to have a super early spring. I mean, the woods are already starting to green up. Our winter wheat's already up like to your ankle. So by turkey season, that stuff's going to be up, you know, almost to your knee probably in a lot of spots. So you got to change your tactics and get in the woods a little bit so your decoys ain't as effective, you know, like that. So it's all situational when it comes to the decoying and the calling. But early season, man, I want to be the loudest, most excited hen you can find out there.
And what's that like for you, Jason? Does similar tactic, different tactics?
So fairly similar, but we have the big change where our Merriams, and I'm sure most of your listeners all know, Merriams Rios out here, when they winter, they end up in these giant flocks of 400 or 500. So you have this almost like, I call it like the turkey migration. They all go disperse in the spring and summer, and then they all come back in the winter, and then you slowly start to get out of that. So a lot of our birds here in like Northeast Washington, Eastern Washington, they're just starting to break out of those big flocks. You know, they're smaller, but they're down around ag at this time a little more. They're a little more patternable. So as much as I sometimes don't like scouting for turkeys, scouting and patterning these birds is going to be really, really effective early in the spring. And then when it does come to calling, like James said, a pretty loud, noisy, bossy hen, trying to get the attention of these birds, you know, is the go-to. Now our Merriams, From what I and Rios, of course, in the same, there's a big intermixing. So when I say Merriams and Rios, sometimes it's like interchange because we don't have purebred Merriams, it doesn't seem like, and we don't have purebred Rios there. They all kind of seem to be across, but I'll say it interchangeably. They don't roost in the, you know, when I go back to Kansas or when I hunted around home, those birds are pretty homebody. They like to roost in the same set of trees over and over until these Merriams, one of the biggest strategies is to go figure out where they're roosted because they'll roost half mile away and they'll do a different, you know, and so while we are trying to pattern them, you're trying to figure out like their overall pattern, what's the highest likelihood of them being in an area. But I honestly don't hunt early here anymore. It doesn't bother me to let the masses come out April 15th to May 1st. I don't even care if I hit the woods until May 5th here. I love that our birds will chase the snow line up. They want to be on the best, freshest, greenest food. as it goes up. And I love hunting them that way. I love to hunt the turkeys as they go back up the mountains. Yeah, there'll always be some stragglers that stay down around the ag and stay low. But a lot of our bird hunting and some of our better turkey hunting is these birds start to go high. So I love that, is James mentioned, you know, those, you get in that time where the majority of his hens are starting to sit, or you also, by letting them go up, you've now maybe just found a tom with two or three hens that are nesting higher on the mountain. It becomes a little easier of a game. And, these Merriams out here, they gobble a lot more. They're, maybe some would say they're a dumber bird, or you know, less sophisticated bird than the Easterns, but you can get them to pipe off all day long. They're a little more talkative, and you know, some would say they're a little easier to hunt. I would say they're funner to hunt. You know, they talk more, they're more responsive, sometimes easier to call in. And so once we do that, it really kind of turns into, you know, me being a diehard elk hunter, it's real similar. You're covering ground, you're just trying to get one to locate. And one of the reasons we developed the call we did, woodpecker was always my go-to. Yeah, you can run around with a loud box call, get these things to gobble, but woodpecker just seems to kind of pull that gobble out of them midday. And a lot of times if we get that bird to gobble, you know, anywhere from 10 to 2 in the afternoon, like, a lot of times we've had really good success. I don't want to throw a number out there, but like, there's a good chance we're going to be able to kill that bird. So that's my favorite way. Yeah, we hunt a lot of trees. A lot of times we get it wrong early in the morning, but then we can stay on those birds, kind of shadow them, let them kind of follow the hens around. But if we can stay with that bird or get them to pipe back off, you know, mid-afternoon or early afternoon, like, that's my favorite way to hunt them. Our best strategy is to set up. You know, a lot of times we will throw a lone hen, you know, sometimes a breeding Jake or a half strut Jake out there with her, depending on the situation, and we will decoy. But a lot of times this run and gun style, like, to get to the place you need to, you can't get a decoy out. So a lot of times we are blind setting as well, you know, on old logging roads or old clear cuts or whatever it may be. And just, you know, kind of playing the hand we're dealt. But I love that run and gun, lightweight. You can hunt these things all day, where sometimes I feel like when I'm in Kansas, I know there's birds there. I know they're there, but they will not talk. They won't, you know, when they're all henned up. And so it's like, give me May 5th in the mountains, and it's the birds are talking and they're super callable.
It's interesting that you say that, because Bo Brooks did a Western hunting seminar at convention, and he said like the exact same thing. He's like, I go out like 2 weeks into the season in May, and he's going up the mountain looking for those birds that are going up, and maybe in, you know, kind of less concentrated numbers, but that has been, you know, one of his strategies that he's successfully used.
A lot of people just shake their head. Like, one of the days we put together last year, we put like 16 miles in on a turkey hunt, but it's something about when you get to that bird, you know that, yeah, it was a lot of work to get to that one, but it's very callable bird. And I don't know. I don't know if it's a Western thing, but you feel like you worked for it, right? Like, you did. Not saying I don't mind killing one on the edge of an ag, but it's cool to kind of chase them in that terrain and kind of do it on their own terms, and probably find a bird that hasn't been talked to for, you know, days or weeks since he left the farm fields, you know, and started to go back up the mountain.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely something special about getting birds that are away from the more developed areas. Even like some of the places that I like to hunt, they're like big river bottoms, stuff like that, that just feel a little bit more wild than cut corn, you know. They can nothing wrong with shooting them over cut corn fields.
Hunt a couple weeks in the Ozark Mountains and you'll take a cornfield every day. I mean, the Ozark make you literally just take up fishing for a living and quit turkey hunting some days. I mean, it's ridiculous. They are so tight-lipped. I mean, it's Kansas times three. Like, we'll go for days and not hear birds gobble, and you know they're there the whole time. And then one day they'll break off and gobble great all day. And if you're not there on that day, then you're just waiting on them again, you know? So It's definitely more rewarding when you can put the legwork in and get down in them hollers and deep spots and get one killed like that, for sure.
Yeah.
Actually, that's a great thing. Like, for people who live in the Ozarks or these other areas where it's not ag fields, whatever, and they aren't hearing gobbling, you know, what what tips would you give them? Like, hey, like, how can I maybe intercept some birds or like find sign where I can set up to where maybe they're not being vocal, but I might be able to catch them, you know, coming into a place quiet or even just catch them moving.
Oh, well, you know, in the Ozarks down there, we're at, that's where I come in with the locator calls. Cause a lot of spots like down here, just below the house, we're hunting a big bunch of public. It's like 98,000 acres. And if the birds ain't gobbling, I mean, what are you going to do? You just walk around and look. So that's where the locator calls, you know, the owls, the crows, the hawk screams, the owl screams come in. Cause you just need to get that bird to gobble. And what we do is we just hit ridges. If it's a dry year, we look for water, you know, we look for a little bit of spot where, you know, the birds are going to focus on. Like last year, we had a phenomenal acorn crop. So, I mean, they're still, them birds are still in the woods scratching on acorns. So we're looking for spots that's got, you know, fresh sign. And if we can hit on fresh sign, we'll spend and concentrate more time on that area. You know, and then like a lot of times down there, you'll have burn areas where they went in and burnt the that spring earlier. So we'll focus in on the burn spots like that, you know, and it's kind of, I'm sure it's like that with elk and like deer. You'll get into some spots that just look turkey. You look at them and you're like, you know what? A bird would use this area. We do a lot of looking on topo maps just to kind of look for the draws and the, you know, if you're hunting big hills, you want to look for the shelves on the side. And just, you know, one thing I always tell guys too is watch the wind direction on turkeys when you're hunting them, because a lot of times if you can get that wind right, your calls are going to carry a lot farther. And then also too, with the foliage and stuff, if they gobble, you may not hear them as, you know, as good as you might be up on top of them and not realize that you might bump them birds. So you got to take all that into consideration on the days when the wind gets really blowing hard. We kind of drop down in the bottom of the hollers with the creeks because the birds are out of the wind, and just focus on that. And you know, we in Missouri on public ground, you can only hunt till 1 o'clock. So I mean, we're there till 1 o'clock. We're not stopping, because I can't tell you how many times at 12 o'clock or 12:15, a hawk's flown over and screamed or something, and a bird gobbled one time. And if you can hear him, you know, then you can get on him. So That's what I always say, man. I carry more locator calls than I do turkey calls, because I know what that hen sounds like and I know what to do there, but I want to make sure I got to find him first. And I mean, out there in Western where Jason's guys hunt, to me, that's just mind boggling, because those mountains are so big. I'd be like, holy cow, where do we start at? You know, the Ozark Mountains are big, but they ain't nothing like that out there. That's
I love. And y'all can tell Gilbert to cut this out if you want to. But I found locator call wise in the Southeast where I hunt in South Carolina, we've got huge pine blocks. And one of my go-to locator calls are like the wooden train whistles that you have as a kid that get really loud, because we've got so many train tracks running around. You hit one of those things and you'll have a bird gobble a couple hundred yards away that won't respond to anything else. But you hit a train whistle just because it's different. And like, oh, I don't have to worry about if there's somebody attached to that thing trying to shoot me. But
going to go out with one of those, the drill gun air horns. Just
This stems on a podcast we recorded with Ranella and Clay Newcomb arguing back and forth over, like, as a hunter, you just want them to get them to gobble. But then, like, as the woodsman, you want to use like a natural sound to get them to gobble. But Steve is like, I don't give it. I'm just a hunter. I want to find the bird. And Clay is like, yeah, but you want to be a woodsman that, you know, you use a natural sound. And we all just left that conversation. Like, as long as you get one to gobble, like, do it your own way. But yeah, we're the same way. Like elk bugling in April, like they'll answer an elk bugle great, cause it's so loud and so high pitched that we do everything, you know, aside from a coyote howl, unless it's at night, because I don't want to put that turkey at, you know, nerves. I feel like a turkey relates coyote howls to getting ate, but that's my go-to for night roosting is they answer a coyote howl almost every time. So yeah, I'm in the same boat. A train whistle, air horn, anything that works. If I can get the game started and know there's a bird in a certain direction, then I'm willing to do it.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of locator calls, we kind of alluded to it earlier, but you guys want to talk a little bit about the new locator call that you have coming out?
Yeah, for sure. I'll kick it off and then I'll kick it back to James. So when me and James got to be, you know, got to know each other, first met, he brought me some calls. He's like, hey, here's a woodpecker call. And, you know, it does some, I don't remember if he said it. He said an owl screamed back then. And I'm like, what the heck's an owl scream? I've heard one, but I don't use that for hunting. And so I just ran it as a woodpecker call the whole time. And it was something that James was building and, you know, kind of, you know, using a different tone board that was more, you know, that was available. We could have used it. And so I think, was it James? We got the owl hooter going last year and we're like, what are we doing next? And you're like, I really want to get this owl screamer going. And I said, only if it can make a woodpecker like that. And so James started kicking the idea and we elected to just build our own tone board from the ground up and worked back and forth, you know, messing with back pressures. And James, I'll kind of let you, we got going, did some 3D printing, trying to make sure that when we got the tone board close, that that's how it was really going to be when it showed up. Cause there's always a little bit of, you know, spec difficulty holding 3D prints perfect. And before you spend a whole bunch of money to go down the hole. And so, yeah, started working with James, sending him samples and playing with different Mylars and different reed cuts and different O-ring grooves. But I think we knocked it out of the park. James can rewind time there a little bit and maybe talk about how we developed this call together and what we both wanted out of it.
Yeah. So yeah, on that. And the reason I started with I'm Missouri, so I'm Midwestern, you know, and the owl screams kind of predominant. You guys hear it all the time. And when you're a competition caller, everybody owl screams. Well, nobody had ever made an owl screamer call to sell or anything like that. So I got the idea. I was like, well, man, I started building them for competition calling. And then I started taking it out in the woods around the house. And man, I'd hit that owl scream and them turkeys would just turn inside out. And I'm like, I'm onto something here because nobody's doing it and the turkeys are not hearing it. So when you go to public ground and hit an owl scream, they're responding to it good. So then I got talking with Jay. He's like, man, we got to do the woodpecker on it and everything like that. And for me, I'm not a woodpecker guy. I hear them all the time, but I can count on one hand around my house how many turkeys, deer, woodpecker, and they just do not gobble at it. Now I can take that same call, hit an owl scream, and they'll gobble every time at it. So it's kind of funny, the location. So we wanted a call that was super easy to use, that was user-friendly, that, you know, really basically I wanted to be able to grab the call up, blow air into it without any hand manipulation or anything and make the sounds that we wanted. And Jason knocked out a part with the tone board. He was working about, you know, hey, the change in the radius. We were playing with it. And in the interim of that, so we nailed the owl scream. We nailed the woodpecker. And when Jason took that tone board and did his magic to it, we also got a hawk scream out of it. So I was like, dude, how wonderful is that? Because you know how hawk screams are. If you hit them midday, them birds are going to gobble at it. And that's something that everybody has is hawks. Everybody's got woodpeckers and stuff like that. So, and the cool thing with the hawk scream, the owl scream, the woodpecker, they're all non-threatening calls. They're not like a coyote howl where you're alerting that turkey to, hey, there's something trying to eat me. I know. Yeah. You can hit that hawk scream or that owl scream and it's loud. It's obnoxious. It's the one call in my house that I'm not allowed to tune in the house. I have a wood shop.
Yeah, and I would love to take credit for that hawk scream, James, but really to like speed the process up, you know, as you're doing this R&D, we were putting these grooves on these calls and I didn't know exactly which spot was going to be like a perfect, as we were making, we ran out of time. And so we were making multiple changes, which as a designer, I like to make one change at a time, figure out. So we were making multiples at a time, changing radiuses. And I'm like, you know, I'm going to throw a couple more O-ring grooves on this tone board and then we'll take them out to at production when we need to move stuff. And James just, you know, he's like, hey, I had messed with it. And but yeah, we can definitely get a hawk scream out. James, like, I'm like, yeah, I meant to do that. I put that right there in the hawk scream location, but it was really just a design element that I put in to hopefully save us time. And it worked well. And, you know, we messed with Mylar and, you know, some of the, we're taking 0.2 millimeter, like you're taking 0.2 millimeters, like it's almost immeasurable off of the, and we're just really tweaking these things, to get them dialed in. And as James mentioned, one thing that, and it also goes back to Philip's point is, are they really gobbling at the woodpecker now, or are they gobbling at this call because it's twice as loud as anything that they get hit with? This call is, if you want it to, I mean, you can keep it at like live volume, you know, but if you want to, you can overblow this woodpecker call, crank it way up. The reed doesn't go anywhere, and you can, you know, out west, I can light up an entire canyon and let you know if I think there's a bird there or not, which for me is a huge advantage, because now I don't have to, you know, use my feet to travel that whole canyon. I can do it all from one side.
Yeah. I tell you how loud they are. When I'm blowing them and playing with them at the house, I wear a earmuff, literally like you guys got on for the podcast, and just kind of crack it off the one corner of my ear, because they're so loud. Literally, if you blow them things constantly, you're going to do permanent hearing damage. That high pitch, it will ring your head. So, you know, if it's that high pitch and that loud, turkeys. I had guys last year when I was working with them, we hunted a farm in Kentucky, and it's a 1,000-acre farm. I was on one side of it, and my buddy was on the other side of it. He's like, I could hear you owl screaming, and he said, you were making all my turkeys gobble, and I was so far off, I couldn't hear his turkeys at all. So that's how far that call is carrying. So, I mean, look at the time and distance, like Jason said, especially where he's at. Dude, you got to be part billy goat to live up there. I mean, he's hitting it and covering a whole canyon, you know, where I'm hitting it. And I mean, I'm probably scaring half the turkeys just to gobble because they're scared to death of it.
And so the on that call, so you mentioned the O-rings. Is it changing the position of the O-ring that changes how the call works?
Yeah. So we call it the tip of the tone board or the base of the board. So the tip of the board, anybody that's played externals, like if you clamp it down, the closer you put your O-ring to the tip, the higher pitch it's going to be. So your hawk will be that real high pitch scream. You roll the O-ring and it's only about a millimeter, 1.3 millimeters. You roll the O-ring down to the middle groove and that gets you your owl scream. And then you roll another 1.3 millimeters and that gives you your woodpecker call. So you're moving this little O-ring through grooves that really just puts the pressure. It forces the reed. Basically, it makes the effective length of the reed shorter. So you have a short reed. It vibrates at a higher pitch. You make it a little longer. It's not quite as high pitch. And then, so all we're doing is moving where that reed gets locked down to the tone board.
It's just like sliding the O-ring on a grunt tube.
Yep.
Where you have like a doe bleat to like mature buck grunt. It's the same
exactly. Place.
So you guys have any other calls that you wanted to talk about? So you mentioned one that's you said was Gracely and Mulberry.
Yeah, so we've got a extremely hard gray slate. It's honestly better than the gray slate we normally get. We got a limited run of this gray slate, and we put it in a mulberry pot, which a lot of people don't look at as a turkey wood. So our plan every year is when we join up with Steve Morgenstern to bring out his signature line of calls. I want to take a domestic wood that may or may not be used. You know, last year we did Osage and we put aluminum in it. This year we took mulberry and put this hard gray slate. And then Steve's always been a huge fan of slate tone boards. And this year he put the gray slate over glass. So changed it up a little bit. And then we took red slate over glass and put it in a Babinga pot.
When you mentioned turkey, like turkey wood. As being what it like for people who maybe haven't built calls or aren't that familiar, what are kind of the like woods that people are like, oh, this is the stuff you make turkey calls out of versus other stuff? Like what's the sort of characteristics that people are looking for typically?
So it's all over. I mean, your domestic wood's going to typically be cheaper, more readily available. So you look at like your black walnut's always the one. You look at your cherries, you look at your cedars, you look at your poplars, you look at these like readily available domestic woods. It's going to be cheap. They're very consistent grained, you know, maple. We actually put our, you know, some calls in maple, mahogany, like very straight grain, because that is your building production calls. You're more comfortable moving forward with those. They're predictable. They're straight grain. Now black walnut throws some wrenches at you because you get an eye or you get a knot. And so we're actually in the process of maybe moving away from black walnut a little bit, but you're just looking for consistency. Steve, we can make any call sound good. But to repeat it over and over at a mass, you know, at a production scale is really what we're after. So, you know, if you look at Mulberry, it's got a little bit of figure, but it's pretty consistent. You look at Babinga, like very consistent. And then it really just comes down to like how exotic you want to go. How expensive do you want to make the call? You know, last year we built some calls out of teak, was one of the signature. Cool. You know, it's the, what are they? I'm going to get the saying wrong, like the wood of gods or the wood, something but it costs that much, but it's a cool wood. It's got all kinds of oil. Basically you can throw it out in your yard and the wood's never going to rot. But you know, you're looking at $40 a board foot for that, or you go with like a domestic cherry and I can get it for $3 a board foot, you know? So it depends on how crazy you want to get, how exotic. And then it's a balance of, we want these to be hunting grade calls. We want these things to be used and we want them to sound as good as possible. So we mess with materials, you know, slates, five times as much as glass, or four times as much as crystal, whatever it may be. And so you try to just, on this call specifically, let's just build the best call we can. On our production line of calls, like, let's give them some variability, let's give them some consistency. A lot of guys want a crystal call, that somebody wants a slate call, somebody might want an aluminum call. So you try to offer a big enough line up there that they can get what they want out of those.
So you've got the combo locator call, the one we just mentioned. You'd also mentioned the Chris Parrish lineup of diaphragm calls.
Yep. So Parrish has had a three pack in our lineup for a long time, but Chris, being the old school guy that he is, he wanted his calls to stay on that old school wide frame, which is fine. And so I tasked him, or I had messaged him like, hey, let's try to build some calls on our medium frame that fits more people. And Parrish would always show up in Kansas. You know, he's building calls for us. He's doing all of his, he's got the ability to build all of his own. And he would show up with these unmarked calls and you would watch him, you know, calling in birds and he's over there doing little bubble clucks, but then he could cut on these or get real loud. And, you know, they were kind of a wrinkly little call that didn't look like they were, he's like, man, this is the call that I love. I said, why have we never thought about bringing these to light? He's like, I don't know if people will like them. They're too light or this or that. And I'm like, man, people don't care what they look like if they can sound like that. Now, not everybody's going to be able to sound like Chris, but if you can get the versatility out of a set of calls, he's like, well, we'll do some thinking. And so I challenged him back like, hey, can you get this right on that medium frame? And we went around three or four times and we finally, he had sent me a batch and it just, he knocked him out of the park. We call it the Rein series, REIGN, and then we kind of took the old chess pieces. So one of them's the queen, one of them's the rook, and one of them's the pawn out of that, and kind of went with that, like, king and queen theme. And they're good. I'm real, real impressed. They're really, really light, and you can get really articulate, but you can really crank them up if you need to. Now, they might not be that great call you want to go cut on all day for locating, but man, for what 99% of the hunters want out of a call, they're going to do it very, very well.
Speaking of the Chris Parrish calls hunting out in Kansas, can you tell us a little bit about the line one calls? For people who have been, who follow the Meat Eater podcast, I'm sure you guys have heard about Steve going down. They cut, it was a black walnut tree, right?
Yeah, we cut one black walnut and one Osage, Boydy arc, you know, hedge, whatever people want to call it. And yep, so the striker was Osage orange, and the pot was black walnut there off of the Kansas farm.
I was talking with somebody about this, and I was like, I'm pretty sure they cut down an Osage orange, and it was the strikers. Had it mixed around in my head. So, but yeah, I don't know. It's maybe tell people about that particular call. What meter has going on with that?
Yeah. So Steve had brought this idea to me, and I'm like, man, it's crazy. Everybody, you know, knows that you just buy wood from in a lot and you build calls out of it. He's like, no, I want to document, like, and then I want to go back to that stump and kill a tree with these calls. And I'm like, nobody's going to care about that. And so I'm willing to admit I was wrong. It was a pretty cool project. So we worked with you guys at NWTF. We had some of these calls, and I believe we gave you guys 20, or there's 20 winners, right? So right now we're doing a thing where if you go join the NWTF, for $35, you'll receive an entry to win one of these limited edition Line One calls that me and Steve personally went and cut down, took to the mill, milled up, shipped it off to the kiln, got it kiln dried, and then worked on getting these all milled up. And one thing that was very important to Steve was, like, everything on this, we knew where all the materials went on this from start to finish. So, you know, the walnut came out of Kansas, the crystal came out of a facility in Illinois, the slate came out of a mine in West Virginia. And then we built this thing up, and it's a beautiful call. The artwork's amazing. And, to boot, the thing sounds really good. So yeah, it was a cool project. I admit I'm man enough to admit when I'm wrong, and Steve was right. And it was a cool little project that I'm glad I did. And, yeah, I believe, the hunt will drop tomorrow on when me and Steve picked a winner and went back and hunted the farm, with these calls. So it should be a good little view there.
Nice. Oh yeah. I'm excited to see. I mean, to me, that's like such a, I'm definitely in that, constituency that idea was targeted at, saying yeah. People think this is, I'm just like, to be able to shoot a turkey on the same tree that you cut your call from. That's just super cool.
We had to stretch it a little bit. Ended up being the same farm. We did set up on the stump one morning and had birds all around us, but they pitched down the wrong direction. So the idea was to sit on that stump. We had to like stretch it to the farm though a little bit.
I mean, close enough.
Yeah.
I mean, can't get much closer.
You can't force it. You can't force it to happen there. We tried.
And they're beautiful calls. Like you can look them up. I've got it pulled up right now. They're absolutely gorgeous. What is the, on the back of it, the kind of like emblem on it?
So we ended up taking a, brass plug, designed it as, Steve and my, you know, signature, which is an important Line One. And then it talks about like where the call came from, the year, and all of that around that medallion. So it kind of gives its place. And then every call is numbered. So we only built, I want to say we tried to get to 1500 and we actually stopped at like 1490 after, you know, bad strikers or bad pots and they were pulled out. So I think they're, everyone's individually numbered. I'd like to say you'd have a chance to get number one, but I know it's already been claimed, but you just never know what number you're going to get in there. And it was a fun process. And, we had a lot of fun with that hunt and, Steve wanted to call it Line One. So you never know if maybe Line Two comes in the future and we go cut down some wood somewhere else. But, it was a fun project.
All right. Well, I guess before we go, have any closing thoughts about Turkey Week with Meteor, maybe like, one last secret out of the pocket turkey hunting tip to go.
Go ahead, James, and then I'll follow up.
Well, my thing I always tell everybody is, you know, it's this year with turkey hunting, everybody getting out there, get your kids out there, get it out, you know, get them out there, let them experience it. Be safe. You know, it's not catch and release. You pull the trigger, you don't get that shot back. So anytime I get a chance to tell people that, you know, with the advancements in TSS and the shotguns and everything we shoot, that just, you know, be careful. You're hunting public ground and stuff like that. Just always make sure you're safe and just enjoy your time. Get out there and connect with nature. Leave the cell phones at home and just get out there and enjoy it. And try to sound like an owl, try to sound like a turkey and have fun.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now James went all like proper and safety. Now I'm not rolling to a tactic, but no, for me, I've always just found and I've always wanted to use my mouth call, right? I consider myself a good caller, but don't be afraid to go out there and use a woodpecker call. Don't, you know, use an owl screamer, use an owl hooter, you know, cut as loud as you can, you know, run a box call, run a pot. And I never used to believe this, but now, you know, at least out west, like one of the guys that taught me to hunt, he would roll out like a bag of strikers, like, you know, it'd roll out and he'd have, and he's like, one of these birds, like we might not be able to hear, but this bird's going to be able to tell, you know, the difference. And sure as heck, like he'd get through three or four strikers and they'd pick up on an acrylic striker that I thought sounded horrible. And, you know, last year we had you know, weren't having success, but ended up calling like three of the five birds in with a box call, had to finish him with it because he was hooked on the box call and we couldn't get him to switch to mouth calls or pot calls to finish him. So, just go out there. Don't be, you know, have the confidence. You can't really screw things up too bad. Don't be afraid to call. And in my opinion, that's why I love spring turkey hunting is I want the interaction. I want these things to call back. And, as long as you're not, you know, boogering them up and educating them too much, like, you know, letting a natural locator out or even a train whistle, whatever it may be, like go out there, try to locate them and have a lot of fun with it. A little bit to what James said, like this is supposed to be a fun time, a pastime. And then, you know, these turkeys, you know, provide this great experience, take it all in, have fun, and enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah. You're the biggest turkey out there when I'm calling. So that's usually what I tell people.
Yeah.
I mean, you're literally in the woods as a grown adult sounding like a turkey. So, I mean, just get out there and have fun. That's the biggest thing I get guys talking like on their owl hooters and stuff. And they're embarrassed to run it or whatever. And I'm like, man, just grab it and run it. It's an owl hooter. I mean, just make it happen, you know, own it. So, that's the thing, you know, most of the time I'm the biggest turkey in the woods when I'm out there hunting. So, they just have fun with it.
Yeah.
That's great advice.
James is coming out to Washington to run around. And so we'll have a little challenge to see whether woodpeckers or owl calls work better now that there's a good owl caller coming. And then we're going to have a little challenge, but might not be the biggest turkey in the woods if I'm standing alongside of him. So he'll be the second.
Hey, I started going to the gym in December to get ready. I'm not going to get out there and just be that guy that they're hooking oxygen up to and life lighting out. So I'm trying my best to get in shape for this thing because I'm excited about it.
Yeah, man. Got to get prepped for that.
I'd bring to the Ozarks, but he'd learn how to go fishing because after about a day or two of turkey hunting them doggone things, he'd be like, you know what, let's just go fishing.
We'll just throw some catfish lines in the water. Let's chill out. Go look for some morels.
I'm totally good with that. I can promise you we'll probably do way better catching fish on some days.
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate your time. And, you know, for people that want more information about the Line 1 calls or about any of the other Phelps offerings, we'll have that stuff in the show notes. You can check it out. And, you know, like always, we appreciate everything that Meat Eater does, working with us, promoting conservation, promoting, you know, our mission of conserving the wild turkey and preserving our hunting heritage, getting people into hunting. We'll catch up with you later. And
I would like to thank the NWTF because without your guys' effort and work here, I probably wouldn't have ever got, you know, hooked on it and would definitely wouldn't have the experience I get in Eastern Washington. And I wouldn't have had, you know, the fire lit underneath me here from being able to hunt them. And so, yeah, thank you guys and the NWTF for everything that they've did to make sure that we get to, at least me out West, get to experience what I do, you know, year in and year out every spring.
Absolutely. And if you're out West, make sure you connect with one of our chapters, you know, get hooked up with other turkey hunters, other guys that are passionate about chasing turkeys. There's a lot of really good people. We have awesome volunteers, awesome, you know, state board and you know, RD guys that are out there who are really passionate about hunting and conservation. And, you know, it's always great to meet people who share that passion.
Hey guys, this is Aaron with The Hunting Public. Each spring we head to the woods chasing turkeys, and one overlooked product that we use religiously is Sawyer permethrin. We've used it for years to keep ticks off of us, and it's worked extremely well. We don't like messing around with Lyme disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, anything like that. So I would highly recommend, if you're spring turkey hunting or spending any time in warmer climates in the outdoors, to use Sawyer permethrin. Learn about their advanced insect repellents and family of technical lightweight water filters at Sawyer.com.
Hey y'all, I'm Jason Hart, founder of Nomad Hunting Clothing. At Nomad, we're bringing simplicity and authenticity back to hunting. Whether you hunt to escape your hectic work life, for locally sourced organic meat, or to socialize with friends, to uphold your favorite family traditions, we're with you and we do the same. At Nomad, we understand your gear's an investment, so our products are engineered and priced for every hunter, tested in the real world, and designed to last. Hunting is in all of us. Nomad is with you.
Bass Pro Shops and the National Wild Turkey Federation stand together to help make a difference for the wildlife and scenic lands that enrich our hunting lifestyle. Since 1973, we have positively impacted more than 22 million acres and invested more than $9 million into wild turkey research, an effort supported by Bass Pro Shops. The restoration of the wild turkey is one of America's greatest conservation success stories, but the work is far from over. Through the continued contributions of partners like Johnny Morris and Bass Pro Shops, the NWTF mission is a movement that is delivering the right conservation work at the right place and at the right scale.